of Ephesians. And as kind of we move towards the fall, and if you're not from this area, summer in South Florida is just sort of, it's more unique. We have some friends that helped us plant Cross Point Church in Winter Park. And just even from moving from Orlando to South Florida, there's just a distinctiveness. And so lots of travel, a lot of people kind of beating the heat a little bit and going to places like Michigan and North Carolina, where we went with our family up to the Northeast. And so as we come back and as we're starting like the back to school things, I just want to take a few weeks just to remind us of what God's called us to be about as a church. What does God call us to be about as Christians? And one of the values we have here at Crosspoint is that we would be people who live generously. And what we'll talk about today is in a culture, in a world of consumption, what does it look like to be people of contribution? And this is not like a sermon like, oh yeah, people of Crosspoint start doing this. The three things that we're trying to do is just remind us of what we're called to be about as followers of Christ. What has Jesus called us to be about as a church? The second purpose is to be encouraged. That when we talk about lives of generosity and lives of contribution at Crosspoint Church here, I just want to encourage, like, this is happening. This is what we're doing. This is how people are already living. But then it is also an invitation, like, hey, what does that look like for us in this season? What does it look like for me to live a life of contribution, to live generously? And so we've gone through it in kind of three different ways. And last week was sort of like the head. What does the Bible call us to be about as Christians? In Ephesians 4, it says that he's given leaders to equip the saints for the work of ministry, for building up the body of Christ. And so God has called us to be about his plans, his purposes, about loving God and loving others. And we may know that. Maybe you've been a Christian for a really long time. You know that. You know that in your head, but sometimes our hearts aren't there. Sometimes we don't have the desire to be about serving God and serving others. And so that's what we'll talk about today. What does it look like to cultivate our hearts to live lives of contribution? And then next week will be more of the hands. Like, how has God gifted you? How can you contribute with your time, with your talent, with your treasure? But today we are going to talk about cultivating the heart and moving from this sort of culture of consumption to contribution. And Josh read Luke chapter 12, and in it, it's sort of a warning passage. Jesus uses the word, he says, take care. He wants you to pay attention, to listen. And warnings aren't always the most, like, pleasant to hear, right? So say your kid's about to, like, walk across the street, or they're about to do something that's probably not a good idea for them, and this changes as they get older. Sometimes you're like, oh no, like, okay, like, feel the repercussions of that a little bit. But there is a, you want to sort of startle or to get their attention. And so that's what Jesus is doing in this parable. He wants to kind of grab us and get our attention to really think about how are we living and what are we living for. And so I want to start with two premises because I'm sort of making an assumption that we live in a culture of consumption. If you just think about the U.S. in general, our place in particular, I think we can all agree, no matter your sort of background, no matter your Christian beliefs or anything, we live in a culture of consumption. There is advertising, there is marketing, there's things that people are saying, like, hey, if you consume this, then you will have life. If you consume this, then you will be happy. I don't know if it's because it's back to school time, but I was talking to a friend the other day. I was like, I feel like my head is spinning with where money's going. You know the guy that's like that? Like, he's like whipping out the money. I'm like, who else wants some money? Who else needs some things, right? You just feel like you're paying for, like, I'm like, what are we paying for anyway, right? But it's just money going everywhere. Maybe it's also that we have three teenagers, right? And so they're doing stuff like, hey, can I get some gas money? Can I grab lunch with my, well, I had a good round of golf. Can I go to dinner with my friends after a good round of golf yesterday, right? And so, like, oh, sure, Apple Pay. I can do this in 0.004 seconds, right? I can just send you some money. Now, if you don't believe or think that we live in a culture of consumption, I would love to grab an $8 coffee with you at any point, right? And I did have the $8 coffee, and then yesterday after a lacrosse tryout, Karina, we were like, let's go to, I was like, I really would like a coffee right now, but I'm a little HM at our house. We call it high maintenance on coffee. And I was like, we just traveled and I drank so much Starbucks and it kind of makes me want to but our favorite coffee shop was only like 10 minutes away. So I was like, oh, Karina's like, we can go there. And I was like, yeah, but she's like, why are we always in a hurry? We can take 10 minutes and go to the coffee shop we love. So we show up there and I was like, I just kind of want a drip coffee. They didn't make drip coffee. So I looked down, it was $15 for a coffee. And I was like, I think that's the price. I don't think they're selling me a bag of coffee. I think that's a price for one. And sure enough, it was. I was like, I'll take the Cortado, please, for $6. Right? It's expensive, right? We live in a culture of consumption. Two quick examples other than my coffee yesterday. This has been what, and so just so you know, like I'll get this in premise number two. This was kind of one of my, I'm not like a big meme guy, but this is one of my favorite more recent memes when Jeff Bezos got married. Did you guys see this one? That everyone's hating on Jeff Bezos' wedding, but I ordered it on Amazon at 10 p.m. last night and it's here at 9 a.m. this morning. And she said, enjoy your wedding, King, right? Like, I am all about it. I'm all about Amazon. I got the Prime. We got these, the camera's like, hey, we need this for worship. I'm like, bam, we'll give you whatever you want, Cameron. Make all this better. Right? And it just shows up the next day. And when I was driving to Orlando last week, do you guys ever just drive up 95 and just see these massive buildings? And then you drive into Orlando and it's like more massive distribution centers. And I looked up one, there's the largest distribution center for Amazon, so we can get consume all our stuff quicker, is 3 million square feet. 3 million square feet. It has 40 million items in it, right? We live in a culture of consumption. We can get what we want as fast as we want. A second example, there are 4 times more self-storage facilities than Starbucks in the U.S. 4 times more self-storage facilities than Starbucks. There are more self-storage facilities than Starbucks, McDonald's, and Subway all combined. Right? Because why? We need a place to put all the stuff we're buying from Amazon. Right? We need a place to put all the stuff that we're storing. One article I read, I think it was called, she's based out of Orlando. She said, on the storage industry, she goes, America, we have a problem. And she said, let me be clear, the storage facilities are not the problem. She said, it's a sad American paradox that we tend to equate quality of life with having more. She said, but the opposite is true. Too much stuff robs us of time, of space, and of money. I'm not sure her religious affiliations, if she's a Christian or not a Christian, but she's in an industry of organization, and I guess organizational people do not like storage units. And so she said, hey, this is actually, these things that are promising life are actually robbing you of life. They're leading to anxiety. They're leading to busyness. They're not giving life. They're actually robbing it. There's this guy named Jesus that said something similar. N.T. Wright said that the modern West world is built on anxiety. It's an anxiety to do more, to get more, to accomplish more. And then when we don't do more or accomplish more, we get sad and depressed, and then we just try to do and gain more. And this is actually the opposite of what Jesus teaches. If you go back in Luke to Luke chapter 9, Jesus said, if anyone would come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross daily and follow me. He said, for whoever would save his life will actually lose it. If you want to actually live life, you'll actually lose it. But whoever loses his life for my sake will save it. And he says, for what does it profit a man if he gains the whole world and loses or forfeits himself? He said, if you live a life of consumption, of making you at the center, of just accomplishing or of just gaining and building on yourself, you actually just lose life. And it's the opposite of what the Christian life is to be about. Sort of a quote I read, there's a book that I probably read every year called The Contemplative Pastor by Eugene Peterson. It's just kind of a reminder, because I know we live in like a fast-paced and just kind of a consuming world, and that creeps into everything, and he's kind of the opposite of that. So he's almost what I'm not and I would like to be. And so when I would read about money or treasure, I tend to read Peterson and then John Piper as well. He's a little just more extreme than I am on views of like material things, but I feel like I always need like a push in that direction. But Peterson talked about this. He said the Eucharistic life, or the life of following Jesus, is to shape our lives as we give ourselves, Christ in us, to be taken, to be blessed, to be broken, and distributed in the lives of witness and service to others, to be about justice or setting things right, of healing and restoration. He said that's what the life is supposed to be about. That's what we're called to be about as Christians. And he says, but this is not the American way. And I'll come back to this, but he says, we Americans, he includes himself, we Americans have developed a culture of acquisition, an economy that is dependent on wanting more, requiring more. We have a huge advertising industry designed to stir up appetites we didn't even know we had. We are insatiable. This is kind of just the air we breathe. Cameron and I are reading a book on preaching. He just talks about like kind of cultural truisms. And it's just like, oh, the more you have, the more you can get, the bigger it is, the happier you'll be. Like that's just assumed in our culture, in our world. Now, this isn't just the world is taking on more things. What Peterson talks about is like this infiltrates Christians. This infiltrates the church. This infiltrates me. He says, it didn't take long for some of our Christian brothers and sisters to develop consumer congregations. If we have a nation of consumers, obviously the quickest and most effective way to get them into our congregations is to identify what they want and offer it to them. Satisfy their fantasies, promise them the moon, recast the gospel in consumer terms. Entertainment, satisfaction, excitement, adventure, problem solving, whatever. And so the church has kind of created this environment of like, let us do all this stuff and you come and consume it and then everybody's happy, right? But yet last week we talked about that the call of the church is to equip the saints for the work of ministry. That we're all called to sacrifice, to serve, to give our lives away for Jesus and for his purposes. And that takes sacrifice. That's costly. Looking at my guys, I woke up two teenagers and our neighbor teenager to be here at 7:15 this morning, right? They much would have rather been sleeping, right? It took a little coaxing to get them out here. Why? It's good for them. It's good for them to come and contribute and to serve and to help build and establish because they matter. And so we're called to live these lives of contribution, but we need to know that it's not just like a consuming out there problem. It's a consuming in here and in our hearts issue. And my second sort of premise is that it affects all of us. I loved how Peterson said, we Americans, because in his little book, the guy's kind of interviewing him and it says like, okay, like how do you preach to your congregation about this, about living in this community, this kind of consumption culture? And he said, and I love this, he says, well, I'm one of them. I live in the same kind of house they do. I drive the same kind of car they do. I shop in the same stores as they do. So I am like them. He said, we're all in this together. That's been one of the biggest challenges that we've had. I'll talk about being rich in good works at the end. And I can look at our lives of moving back here the last nine years and, you know, we haven't done this perfectly, but I'm like, oh yeah, we've sought to be faithful, to live lives of contribution, to sacrifice, to serve, to help establish and build this church. And I'm like, yeah, there's more ways we could have done it. But I think one of the biggest challenges that we have is how do we live that life of sacrifice in this place, in a place of consumption? And it's exhausting and it's expensive and we're still trying to figure it out. It's challenging. We're all in this together. And so what we want to look at today in this culture of consumption, how do we cultivate hearts of contribution? How do we cultivate hearts of generosity? And this is what Jesus does. And he does it in two ways. The first thing that Jesus does is he identifies the lie that consumption brings life. Consumption actually will just take your life. He identifies a lie that the more you have, the more it will lead to life. But he doesn't just kind of leave us there. He gives us a vision for what true life is. What does a life of contribution lead to? What does that look like? And so we'll start with just sort of this lie. The lie that more leads to life. We see in this chapter or in this section, Jesus is doing some teaching. In some ways, he was teaching to a crowd, but then he was teaching to his disciples. But then there would have been a crowd that was behind them that would have been listening to the teachings of Jesus. They would have been hearing him. So, church, we can learn something about that, because Jesus was talking about following him to his disciples, but there's other people that are a part of the conversation to learn what that actually means. And so he starts teaching, and he's teaching on these big things. He's teaching on forgiveness. He's teaching on eternity. He's teaching about who God is. And then this guy, it says, someone in the crowd said to him, "Teacher, tell my brother to divide the inheritance with me." And so it says, some say that it says, since it says teacher, that's what like the Pharisees or the religious leaders would call him. His disciples tended to call him like master or Lord. So some say like it's a religious teacher, but Jesus is teaching on all these big, big ideas of who God is. And then this guy comes in and he says, "Hey, tell my brother to divide the inheritance with me." A lot of people think it would have been like the younger brother, because in that culture there would have been the older brother, and he would have been kind of in charge of the inheritance, and he could have kind of done with it what he wants. So this guy is like the younger brother, like, "Hey, I want to get my fair shake in this." But what it does is we learn early what his heart is. One pastor said that this guy has one chance to talk to Jesus. Say, you have one chance to talk to Jesus. You have one chance to talk to the guru of your day, right? And what does he do? Does he talk to him about eternity? Does he talk to him about forgiveness? Does he even talk to him about, "Hey, how can I get along with my brother?" No, what does he talk to him about? Money. I want my stuff. He talks about acquiring more. It reveals his heart. We're just getting little snippets. We're getting little glimpses into his heart. And Jesus knows this, and he doesn't directly engage him. He doesn't even answer his question. He says, "Well, who am I? Like, that's not my man. Who made me a judge or arbitrator over you?" So he like deflects the question, but instead he gets a more important question. He engages and exposes his heart, and he begins to warn him of the hazards of what he's preoccupied with. And one thing that you see in the scriptures as we talk about money and consumption and stuff, John Piper talks about that money is just like neutral. Money's not positive or negative. It's just it's a neutral thing. Money's not really an issue at all. A lot of times Christians will make money feel like it's an issue, but it's the love of money that is an issue. As we'll see in 1 Timothy, it's the desire to be rich is an issue. But money is just neutral. And what Piper talked about, that Jesus and the apostles, they viewed money in two ways. They viewed money as something that was as hazardous, that could actually lead to destruction, that could lead to devastation, that could lead to harmful things, or as helpful. Jesus always views money as helpful. If it can lead to destruction and devastation and fracturing of relationships and families and all the things that we know that money can do, it also can be used for a lot of helpful things. It can be used for caring for people and building things. and bringing flourishing. And so Jesus's view on money and his teaching on money is one, he wants us to minimize the hazard of money, minimizing how money can hurt, and also maximize the helpfulness. That's what he's doing. He's wanting us to how can we maximize the helpfulness of money? How can we maximize the helpfulness of what we have? And if money is neutral, but it can either be hazardous or helpful, the second thing it does is it represents what we value. What we do with our money represents what we value. Jesus says, and just down a couple of verses, he says, where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. It represents what we value. Our kids. We spend a lot of money on our kids, right? It's there. We value this church. We give a lot of time. We give a lot of resources to this church. I can overvalue this church. And I can give too much time and too much thought and too much effort and neglect other things. But money just simply represents what we value. And that's where Jesus gives this warning. He's like, hey, just so you know, money can be very hazardous or it can be very helpful. And let me warn you. And that's what he says in verse 15. He says, and he said to them, take care and be on your guard against all covetousness. For one's life does not consist in the abundance of his possession. He says, take care, be on guard against all covetousness. Covetousness is not a word that we use a lot. It just simply means the lust to have more than one fair share. A lust to have more than one's fair share. A boundless grasping for more. Peterson talked about this actually is not called covetousness in our culture. This boundless grasping for more. It's actually promoted and it's just called advertising. Right? And advertising exists to create a sense of discontentment. Oh, I need that thing. You know, half the time I'm like, I didn't even know that thing existed. Right? But I need it. Now, Amazon, send it to me tomorrow at 8 a.m. Or 4 to 8 if I want it by the time I wake up. Right? Advertising, marketing, covetousness—it creates a sense of disconnection. But Colossians 3:5 says that covetousness is idolatry. That if the first commandment is to worship God, the 10th commandment is do not covet. He says don't covet because it leads to destruction. It leads to devastation. 1 Timothy 6:9 says those who desire to be rich. Again, it doesn't say those who are rich. He says those who desire to be rich fall into temptation, into a snare, into many senseless and harmful desires that plunge people into ruin and destruction. I've been a pastor for nearly 20 years now. I've just seen this over and over and over again. And it's not like just like friends, some of my best friends. This is their story. An over desire for more. And we see how it devastates families, devastates businesses. Heck, it devastates our economy. Like when do economies crash? Like, oh, look, we're going to do things in an unhealthy way. It's an over desire more. And Piper put it this way. He says, Jesus saying, not only is this inheritance not your life, not only is this inheritance not your life, it's about to take your life. It's about to destroy your relationship with your brother. Where this is going, it's going to bring destruction. Again, we have all seen it. Maybe some of us have experienced it. He's saying take care and be on guard against all covetousness because it's hazardous. It can lead to destruction. And he says, because life does not consist in the abundance of possessions. The Pillar Commentary talked about this. They talked about that there's three words for life that Jesus could have used. He could have used bios. This is basically like how biology, how long you one lived, kind of the goods acquired. It's the quantitative life. How long you live, how well you live, kind of like your health. And in some sense, more money can extend that, right? We were talking about like to eat healthy is very expensive. If you eat cheaply, it's actually bad for your health. That's why it's super depressing. I'm from St. Louis, and a lot of grocery stores were leaving the sort of lower income neighborhoods and areas because they were too dangerous. And so, not just like family, like neighborhood after neighborhood, like their grocery store is like the Dollar General, where everything's just stored, and it's super unhealthy, right? Because it's cheaper, right? So he's saying you could actually extend life by this bios. Or there's another word that's psyche, like the qualitative nature of life, like your values and how you live, and that's important. But what he uses here is the word zoe. It means life. It means the quintessential life. It's the truest form of something, and it's the fullness of life. It's what we were created for. And and what he's driving at is that true life comes from God and our relationship with Him. And he's saying, only when you have that life, that true life that leads to contentment, that leads to peace, that leads to joy, that can't be measured, that can't be satisfied by stuff. True life, what we're created for, can never be satisfied by what we acquire, by what we consume, right? It all breaks. It all ends up in the garage. Then I'm trying to get out of the garage, right? They switched the uniforms here at JCS this year. And so what did I do? Got rid of all the old uniforms. We don't need those anymore. And then I learned there was like this grace period that you don't have. I was like, no, where did I throw those away at? Because I didn't want to buy new uniforms. I'm like digging through the garage, looking for them again. Found a couple. Right? We get rid of stuff. It can't satisfy. And what Jesus is saying, and this is what Pillar said, it says, be on your guard, says Jesus, against trying to achieve and satisfy Zoe life, real life, true life, have contentment, have peace, have joy. Be on your guard against trying to satisfy yourself with things. Or an over desire for things. If I had that, if I did that, if I got to go there, then I would truly be living life. And we need to ask ourselves, because Jesus is kind of passionate about this, right? It's kind of like one after the other. Truthfully, I was thinking the sermon was going to be a little bit more on being rich towards God. And then I was like, no, Jesus spent all this time talking about the warning part of it. So I better spend a little more time there. On that, and then we'll get to that part at the end and next week. So that's coming. But why is Jesus so adamant about this? And in verse 16, this tells this parable that reveals the lie. It reveals the deceitfulness of riches, the hazard of riches, of what leads to destruction and devastation. He tells this parable for them to learn. It says, the land of a rich man produced plentifully. And he said, he thought to himself, what shall I do? For I have nowhere to store my crops. And he said, I will do this. I will tear down my barns and build larger ones. And I will store all my grains and my goods. And I will say to my soul, soul, you have ample goods laid up for many years. Relax, eat, drink, and be merry. And he says, but God said to him, fool, this night your soul is required of you, and things that you have prepared, whose will they be? So is the one who's laid up treasure for himself and is not rich towards God. Jesus warns them and he gives them a lesson. And there's some things that we see in Jesus' lesson that I want to pull off that can, why would Jesus be so adamant about that? And before I get there, though, I want to start with this. I want us to know what Jesus is not saying. Jesus is not saying that success is bad. He says, the land of the rich man produced plentifully. It doesn't say that he cheated somebody. He doesn't say he took from others. He doesn't say that he was successful because he did anything wrong. In fact, he says that the land produced. It was from God. And one thing that we need to know, and knowing success isn't bad, is under all our success is a God who provides. You begin to see that everything you have, where you are, what you have, goodness, all comes from God. And so what he is not saying is that being successful is wrong. He doesn't even say building bigger barns is wrong. That could have been a really good idea. But the problem was his heart, what he wanted to do this. So I want us to hear, before we get into like, hey, where's the hazard? Success isn't bad. Money can be helpful. Building businesses is helpful. Employing people is helpful. Being generous is helpful. You know what you need to be generous? Stuff. You need money. There's nothing wrong. I love that we have business people in this church that love to build things, love to establish things. They make money and they use it for good. I got a couple examples and a couple of people are out this week, so that's probably helpful. Larry and Mary Ellen, he took on the family business and he built it into something bigger, and it was storage units. And he built it, and he kind of spread it, and him and his cousin, and it was great. And then they sold a portion of it. And when they sold a portion of it, they took that and were helpful with it and gave it to churches and ministries that they were affiliated with. And one of them is Key Life, Steve Brown, that they've been a part of, and he's on the board with them there. And so he gives to Steve, and Steve goes, awesome. Good job. Go do it again. Go build another business. Go make more money. Go give some more, right? That's the mentality. It's not bad to be successful. God wants you to build. God wants you to establish. God wants you to do these things. But the problem is our hearts. And that's what Jesus is exposing. And you see it with this man. One commentator said that there was an ingrained selfishness. An ingrained selfishness. If you read the parable, he uses my 4 times. He uses I 8 times. There was no thought. There was no thought of sharing. There's no thought of stewardship. There was no thought of how might the God who gave me all this, how might he want me to use it? What would be his purposes? What would be his plans? How could I further his kingdom? How could I do things like caring for the poor, providing for those in need? Where is there need? It was all me, my, I. It was all about self. And if you live that way, it leads to the second thing that we see. It leads to loneliness. A life of consumption will lead to loneliness. The guy is literally talking to himself. He's alone. There's nobody he can trust. There's nobody that he's around him. When we live for stuff, it leads to being isolated and being alone. Flip side of that, when we are generous, when we are contributors, it leads to health and relationships and the flourishing of all the people around you. This one is here, so I'll embarrass them. I get the pleasure of living next to Manny and Chrissy, who happen to be probably the most generous people I've ever met. They are constantly just giving. They have people at their house all the time. And he's giving and taking care of them and supporting them. Kids babysit for them. He had the kids out front. They were like waxing the boat and cleaning the boat, right? And then gave them a steak dinner afterwards. And I'm like, Weston's like, can I eat with Mr. Manny? It's steak. And I was like, what do you mean? You don't want the chicken nuggets and the bag of Caesar salad that I'm about to feed you, that dad cooked? What do you mean? What's wrong with that? Right? They're not alone. They're not isolated. They have people that love them and care for them and will do anything for them. Why? Because they live lives of generosity and contribution. Consumption leads to loneliness. And the last thing we see is this man was foolish instead of faithful. He was foolish instead of faithful. It says, "And I will say to my soul, soul, you have ample goods laid up for many years. Relax, eat, drink, be merry." And said, "But God said to him, fool, this night your soul is required of you. And the things you have prepared, whose will they be anyway?" More than one commentator said the same thing. This is the closest picture. This is kind of the only time that the Bible speaks to something of the American dream of retirement. This is the only time the Bible kind of speaks of our version of retirement. And he says it's foolish. He says it's foolish. He's saying it's foolish to live a life that is all about you. He's saying what's not foolish is living a life that is investing in others and pouring in others and caring for others and building others up. It's one of my favorite things about the more mature aged here at Crosspoint. They live lives of contribution. They live lives of generosity. They're caring for their kids and for their grandkids and for those that are around them. One of the most beautiful examples is Anne. Anne, like, retired from being a teacher after, what, Kate, 20 years, 30, 20? 20 years of caring for other people's kids, right? And she invested in her kids who are scattered around. She invested in her grandkids, right? But she takes it all a step further. And Anne's got her own challenges that she has. She takes care of Crosspoint kids. She's back there serving. And she was going on a little trip this weekend, and she texted later this week. She goes, "Hey, can somebody fill in for me at the assisted living home where her dad lives, who she also takes care of?" Right? And she goes, I was like, yeah. What do we need her? She goes, "Well, I go in on Monday at 12:30 and we have a Bible study. And like the memory care portion of it." And she's like, "All you have to do is you just show up and you open the Bible and we just read it." I was like, "Well, I can do that. I'm a pastor. Anybody can do that." Right? So not only does she take care of her dad in the assisted living facility, she started a Bible study in the assisted living facility and cares for them as well. Right? Usually when I see Anne, how you doing? I'm exhausted. I'm tired. Why? She is pouring herself out for the good of others. Yes, she is taking care of her kids. Yes, she's taking care of her grandkids. Yes, she's taking care of her dad. Right? But truthfully, you don't actually need to be a Christian to do that. That's kind of what most people do. She takes care of more than that. A life of contribution, of generosity with her time, with her talent, and with her treasure. And Jesus would say, "Well done, good and faithful servant." And he would also say, it's foolish to live for things that you can't bring with you. It's foolish to live for things that can't bring you life. He says it right there. He says, "But this night your soul is required of you." And he's like, "And the things you have prepared, the things you have done," he's like, who are they going to be? What are you going to do with it? So you're going to a box. Guess what? Your kids don't want it. Right? My kids don't want my junk. He warns us because he knows the love of money. It leads to selfishness and loneliness, and ultimately it's foolish. And then he flips it and he gives us vision for that which is truly life. I'll go through these faster. We'll talk about it more next week, right? He says, "So is the one who lays up his treasure for himself and is not rich towards God." Piper said the word "rich towards God" is unusual. What does it mean to be rich towards God? If Jesus says, "Do this," what does that actually mean? And he said, the meaning is plain from the contrast. It is the opposite of laying up earthly treasure for yourself. Being rich towards God is the opposite of treating the self as though it were made for things and not for God. The opposite of treating the self as though it were made for things and not for God. Being rich towards God is the opposite of acting as if life consists in the abundance of possessions and not in the abundance of knowing God. And so he's saying true life, true flourishing, a life that matters comes from a life of knowing God. It's It's the heart being drawn to God as our treasure. It's moving towards God and valuing and knowing Him above all things. It's being devoted to knowing and valuing God. What was on this guy's mind? Money. What was on his heart? Money. What drove his actions? Money. And what he is saying is like, what needs to be on our mind is God. What needs to be on our heart is God. What needs to drive our actions is God. Value of knowing Him. There might be a slide for this. The second thing, it means having our earthly riches, our time and our talent and treasure, reveal that we value God. Again, we give ourselves to what we value. And we need to look at what we do with our time, what we do with our talent, what we do with our treasure, which we'll talk about next week. How are we using that to be rich towards God? That's what he's talking about. It means using what God has given us for the good of others. It's to invest in Jesus's church. It's to invest in Jesus's people. It's to invest in Jesus's mission throughout the world. Using what God has given us for the good of others. And lastly, Eugene Peterson says, it's about being about the common Christian acts of sacrificial love, of being about justice, of setting things right in a world that where things have gone wrong, and bringing hope in the midst of a culture of consumption. Jesus is saying, I want you to have life. I want you to have a rich life. And that comes from being rich towards God. Like, well, my heart isn't drawn towards God. Well, learn about Him. Seek to understand Him. Seek to grow. Ask Him. He's saying, use your earthly riches for God's purposes, for the good of others, to be about His mission in the world. This is the invitation. This is what it looks like to be rich. And as we move towards communion, it's a display of the life of Jesus, correct? This is what Jesus did. God was His ultimate treasure. Right? What Jesus did with His time and His talent and treasure. What did He value? God, people. He gave Himself for the good of others. He sought to love and set things right and bring hope. Jesus compels us to live this life of contribution. 2 Corinthians 8:9 says, "For you know the grace of our Lord Jesus Christ, that though He was rich, yet for your sake He became poor, so that you, by His poverty, might become rich." Jesus came for you. He died for you. He became poor. He was naked, nailed to a cross. To what? Make you rich. To bring you life. To give you an inheritance. And that's what compels us. That's what controls us. 2 Corinthians 5 says, "For the love of Christ controls us, because we have concluded this, that one has died for all, therefore all have died, and He died for all, that those who might live no longer what live for themselves, but for Him who for their sake died and was raised." When you understand the generosity of Christ, His love for you, His sacrifice for you, His giving all things for you, one, you have all you need. And two, it frees you to love like Him, to sacrifice like Him, to live lives of contribution for Him. And so we need to ask, how does Jesus compel us to live lives of contribution? What does it look like for me to be rich towards God? There's four simple things at Crosspoint that you can just do here. You can engage in worship. When you show up, it shows like, this is what I value. I'm taking my time to worship God because He's ultimate. That's why He said He gave us a Sabbath, a day that's set apart as holy. We can connect in community because that's where we're serve and serve others. Our community groups will start back up. You can serve on Sunday mornings. That's why we want to do this. It's like, hey, how can we connect? How can we serve? We can give of our finances sacrificially. That's why the Old Testament talks about give 10%. Why? It says, give your first fruits, give it first, because God, you're the most important. You have the most value. I'm going to trust you that you will provide all I need. So we can engage, we can connect, we can serve, and we can give. And then we go into the world to worship God, to connect others to him, to serve them, and to give towards them. Let's pray.